Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Intercepted. I'm Murtaza Hussain.
I am incredibly honored to be with you here in Ghana and to the people of this incredible continent, to the people of Ghana, and to all the young leaders with us today, students, entrepreneurs, activists, advocates. It is my extraordinary honor to be with you.
Last week, Vice President Kamala Harris wrapped a historic tour of Africa. Harris started off her three-nation visit in Ghana.
As President Joe Biden said at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit last December, we're all in on Africa. We are all in.
Harris's visit comes after a decade of China heavily investing in infrastructure throughout the continent and in critical resource mining. And her trip comes after another major foreign power, Russia, has also set its sights on growing its influence in Africa.
So then, what does it mean that the United States of America is all in? It means that the United States is committed to strengthen our partnerships across the continent of Africa. Partnerships with governments, the private sector, civil society, and all of you. Partnerships based on openness, inclusiveness, candor, shared interests, and mutual benefits. And to be clear, America will be guided not by what we can do for our African partners, but what we can do with our African partners.
During her week-long visit, which also included Tanzania and Zambia, Harris announced plans to boost economic investment and trade, as well as plans to open a plant to process minerals needed for electric vehicles. In February, Jose W. Fernandez, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, echoed the U.S.'s push to position itself as an economic ally to African nations. At the Indaba Mining Conference in South Africa, he spoke about the U.S. being an economic partner to trust.
The partners will evaluate how they plan to avoid worsening environmental degradation and social inequality, and how they can involve local communities. Not only is this the right thing to do, but we also believe that this will result in stronger investment returns. And this is why we must lead a race to the top.
U.S. interest in Africa is not new, but recently it has been more focused on military aid and training rather than economic investment. Over the last 20-plus years of the War on Terror, the U.S. military footprint on the continent has grown tremendously, and it has had devastating consequences that are little understood or acknowledged.
The U.S. Special Operations Command Africa conducted Flintlock 2023 from March 1 to 15 in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire. In a digital press conference on the purpose of Flintlock, Commander of the U.S. Special Operations Command Africa, Rear Admiral Jimmy Sanders, said the U.S. is focused on the threat of Al-Qaeda's continued expansion through the Sahel.
Flintlock is an annual training sponsored by U.S. Special Operations Command Africa, or SOC Africa. Since 2005, the program has provided tactical training to exchange best practices, according to Rear Admiral Milton Jamie Sands. But a recent Pentagon report has found that the Sahel, which includes 11 African countries that sit between the Sahara Desert and the Tropical South, now accounts for 40% of all violent activity by militant Islamist groups in Africa, more than any other region in Africa. Our guest today recently asked Admiral Sands about the flintlock trainings and how they've undermined the very mission of the program.
Our next question will go live to Nick Terse of The Intercept.
Admiral Sands, thanks for taking questions today. Last year, you told me that SOC Africa training always focuses on the importance of democracy and civilian oversight. But former flintlock attendees have conducted at least five coups since 2015. Did you take any specific steps to ensure that flintlock 2023 attendees don't do the same? And if so, what were these?
Yes, Nick, again, thanks for the question and hello. You know, this is a concern. And a consideration with any partner in any training or engagement. Flintlock, as I've said, really focuses on respecting the rule of law, respecting and learning about the law of armed conflict, and on civil control over the military. As we work with our partners, we emphasize the importance of our shared values. This really has been consistent, and we continue to focus on this and really increase our focus on this. Specifically, as you asked, Nick, you know, what have we done now? How is it different this year? I would say that while we always focus on the rule of law, we've really developed a much more thorough plan and integration for effects on that. So we're looking not just at our coordination with our partners on rule of law, but also our coordination with our partners on integration with the police forces, on integration with a whole of government approach to tackling some of these challenges. But I think that, you know, we remain obviously concerned. We remain focused and committed to partners with shared values to the United States and our allies.
I'm now joined by Nick Terse, contributing writer for The Intercept, reporting on national security and foreign policy, and no better person to speak with about the impact of the U.S. military's presence in Africa. Nick, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So, Nick, you've been covering U.S. military operations in Africa for many, many years, and one of the few reporters to do it on such a consistent basis. It's a region of the world where there's relatively less coverage, and many people don't know what the extent or scope of the U.S. military presence in the region is. Can you talk a bit, very broadly, about what AFRICOM is in the context of the U.S. military and what it does in Africa?
Sure. AFRICOM, or U.S. Africa Command, is the umbrella U.S. military command. They call it a geographic combatant command that's responsible for the entirety of Africa except for Egypt, which is in the domain of CENTCOM. And AFRICOM was established in late 2007, became operational in 2008. And in that time that it's been in operation, AFRICOM has built a archipelago of military bases across the northern tier of Africa, stretching from the east to the west. And they run military operations all across the continent. We're talking everything from run-of-the-mill training missions to direct action, special operations missions, that's commando raids, drone strikes, and the like.
Do we have a sense of which countries the U.S. has a military presence in Africa under the aegis of AFRICOM, and what countries they're carrying out the operations that you alluded to just now?
AFRICOM has a presence, what they call a footprint or base posture, so an actual physical base in about 15 countries across Africa. The countries with the largest U.S. presence at the moment would be Djibouti, where the U.S. has its one lone acknowledged military base, which is Camp Lemonnier. They have a series of outposts in Somalia. These were shut down for the most part at the end of the Trump administration. They're being built up under the Biden administration right now. And then in Niger, in West Africa, the U.S. has a robust presence with several military bases and a CIA outpost as well.
So, you know, you've reported quite extensively about specific operations and, you know, strikes and attacks and so forth in the aftermath of them, and corruption and other illicit activities in and around this military footprint, as you described it. You know, I think a lot of people don't actually understand what the mission is of AFRICOM in the region. Like, who are they fighting? Who are they ostensibly there to fight? You said 15 different countries too, and what unifying threat justifies being there for 15 different countries? Or what is the war that AFRICOM currently is there to fight? And who is on the other end ostensibly of these strikes and raids and so forth?
Yes, this is, I think in many respects, you can think about Africa as ground zero of the now nameless U.S. war on terror. You know, the Pentagon talks a good game about moving on to, you know, a near-peer conflict, you know, great power competition. But in Africa, the war on terror goes on unabated. And, you know, this is really, it's been going on now for more than 20 years. In the aftermath of 9/11, the U.S. was, you know, casting around for places to fight the war on terror. They looked around the world, and they happened upon the idea of ungoverned spaces or undergoverned spaces, places that they saw as blank spaces on the map where terrorism might flourish. Now, if you look at U.S. military literature from around the time of 9/11, 2000, 2001, 2002, you find that the Pentagon wasn't able to actually name one transnational terror group in sub-Saharan Africa. But nonetheless, they started pumping counterterrorism funds into what they considered to be potential hotspots in Africa. So Somalia, and also in the West, in the Sahel region of West Africa. And in the time since, there's been a great flourishing of terrorist groups, militant groups on the continent. Again, at the time of 9/11, they weren't able to identify any. Now they identify about 50 different terrorist groups or militant groups operating on the continent. In East Africa, it's the primary enemy that the United States is fighting would be Al-Shabaab in Somalia and a small ISIS affiliate there. And in the West of Africa, in the Sahel region, specifically Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, the U.S. has targeted ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliates in that region.
So I wanted to break down and ask you about some specific countries you've done extensive reporting on the consequences of U.S. military actions, in particular Niger, where you've done some really important reporting recently. Obviously, the U.S. government's there ostensibly under the framework of the war on terror to help the Niger government fight Islamic extremist groups in the country. What has the impact been of that war? And do you know anything about the local dynamics which have led it to be yoked into the war on terror?
In West Africa, specifically the Sahelian region, where the countries of Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali meet, the tri-border region, there's been a tremendous uptick in terrorist activity, especially over the last decade. But over the last 20 years, the United States has focused on this area and pumped more than $500 million in counterterrorism funds, security assistance, into this into Niger specifically. And Niger now hosts the largest and most expensive drone base run by the U.S. military in Africa, in the city of Agadez. It was built at a price tag of more than $110 million, and it's maintained to the tune of about $20 to $30 million each year. It's a surveillance hub and a linchpin of U.S. security architecture in the region. You know, the United States has had a difficult time with its allies in the region. There have been a couple coups in neighboring Burkina Faso, which has caused the United States to dial back some of its security assistance there. The government in Mali also succumbed to a coup, and since then has distanced itself from the West and embraced the Wagner Group and Russian security assistance. So Niger has become, you know, ever more important to the United States as the primary place where it can, you know, fight terror in the region. But, you know, if you look at the metrics, they've all gone in the wrong direction. The United States began providing counterterrorism assistance to Niger in 2002. At that time, you know, there were only 9 terrorist attacks in all of Africa, according to the State Department. Last year, the number of violent events in the tri-border region, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, reached close to 2,800, according to the Pentagon's own statistics. So this is a jump of more than 30,000%, over the last 20 years. So it's, while correlation doesn't equal causation, we're looking at, a tremendous uptick in terror attacks, also in fatalities from them, over the same years that the United States has made this area a counterterrorism focus.
Well, it's interesting because what you're describing very similarly tracks U.S. military operations. The correlation between increase of terrorism and more military operations in the Middle East, obviously, you know, there was political destabilization triggered by many of those wars and so forth. But as you said, Africa or parts of Africa have become terrorism hotspots during the time that the U.S. has been there operating ostensibly to fight terrorism, you know, for 2 decades now. So, you know, kind of awkwardly, the U.S. also through AFRICOM, as I understand, provides military training to partner militaries in Africa, or local governments who are allied with the U.S. will send their officers to the U.S. for training. And we see this in other parts of the world too, in Egypt and Pakistan and other places where the U.S. wants to have close ties with governments where the state is relatively weak but the military is strong. They will cultivate military leaders, or young officers will go on to become leaders in their armies and have a relationship with them going forward. Now, as you've reported, it's a very, very interesting story in The Intercept. In Africa, many U.S.-trained leaders have gone on to take very important political roles in their country when they go back, including embarking on coups at times in their countries to depose leaders, civilian leaders, and put themselves in place. Can you talk a bit about the coup history of U.S. military-trained officers in Africa and how it's played out in recent years?
Yes. Yeah, this is something that's it's come to the attention of Congress recently. There's finally been some questions asked. The United States actually last month just wrapped up its signature special operations counterterrorism exercise. It's called Flintlock, and you know this Flintlock operation has been going on now since 2005. Flintlock attendees have conducted at least 5 coups in the last 8 years. And since 2008, U.S.-trained officers have attempted at least 9 coups and succeeded in at least 8 across 5 West African countries. Burkina Faso 3 times, Guinea, Mali 3 times, Mauritania, and the Gambia. So, you know, in a perverse way, you know, this might be the most successful of all, U.S. military engagement on the continent, because it's the one area that you can point to where the U.S. has shown real results, not the results that the United States would want to brag about. But they have embraced officers who have been militarily successful in one way. And that's in overthrowing their governments, and in many cases, democratically elected governments.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, you mentioned earlier that part of the reason that the U.S. was compelled to get involved in Africa militarily through AFRICOM was the idea of weak states or ungoverned zones being a threat anywhere in the world where terrorist groups could potentially form and so forth. One thing that I found in other parts of the world, and I'm curious in your take reporting on the ground in sub-Saharan Africa, is that a lot of times the U.S. gets looped into local ethnic rivalries, which maybe had no relation to transnational terrorism, but get put into that framework either while the U.S. is there or because the U.S. is there as a means of galvanizing people against one another or against a foreign presence. Can you talk a bit about, you know, in the countries, I was thinking very much in Niger, for instance, what is the ethnic dynamic in the country and how much is that pre-existing to the U.S. presence there? And how has the U.S. played in? Have they taken sides between ethnic groups and deemed it the war on terrorism? I also get the impression that the U.S. is not very sophisticated in its understanding of the dynamics of various parts of the world. And I'll say this for, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, where they didn't really know the tribes, they didn't know the religions or ethnic groups, but they kind of got involved. Is the same sort of naivete or indifference also manifesting in U.S. military operations in Niger and other countries?
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. You see this across the Sahel, very much so in Niger, also in neighboring Burkina Faso. The ethnic group, the Fulani, they're also known as the Pul. They're semi-nomadic Muslim cattle herders. And across the region, they have, you know, long-standing grievances with their governments. You know, there's been, you know, government neglect of their communities, a lot of socioeconomic want in the community, and the communities have been stigmatized in many ways, tagged as terrorists. This stigma has further marginalized them, encouraged abuse by government troops, and also encouraged recruitment by terrorist groups, you know, preying upon these grievances. And, you know, if you talk to U.S. military personnel in the region, there doesn't seem to be an understanding of this. That, you know, again, you know, as you said, in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a great deal of naivete when it comes to an understanding of longstanding ethnic grievances. And, you know, the U.S. has thrown its support behind the government in Niger, pumped a tremendous amount of money into, you know, quote-unquote professionalizing these security forces. But if you talk to the Fulani or Pul community, they'll tell you that security forces are often used as an ethnic militia for ruling elites. You know, and I don't think the United States has ever understood this in any kind of real way, that you know, that their security assistance is it's really fed terrorism throughout the region and specifically in Niger. There was recently a UN report that showed that you know, the number one reason for people joining terror groups across Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, and five others. Sub-Saharan African nations was due to socioeconomic marginalization and also from you know, government abuse, abuse by security forces, and you know, this is something that just the United States doesn't seem to have a appreciation for or any kind of remedy for.
Yeah, I was skeptical if the U.S. invaded Iraq with understanding the difference between Sunnis and Shias or invaded Afghanistan with understanding the ethnic differences in the country, that they would devote or understand, you know, in our Africa, where they devote less resources to understand even better the tribal differences and ethnic differences, which may come into play. So I'm not too surprised to hear that, unfortunately. So this kind of brings me to the next question. In these conflicts, the U.S. has been taking the side of states. So they take the side of the Nigerian government or the Niger government or the Somali government. And they are allied, arrayed against these ethnic groups, which may sometimes be joining terrorist organizations or pledging allegiance to them, sometimes in defense against the government or what they see as government abuses. In the context of these wars, which the U.S. public has not paid very close attention to, are there particular abuses or instances of civilian casualties which you've reported on, which you think are quite egregious but have not risen to public attention?
Yes, most definitely. You know, and I should make you know, some distinction here as well, that you know, the U.S. military, the Pentagon, doesn't seem to have a very good appreciation of this. The AFRICOM itself never seems to, you know, understand these dynamics. But if you read the State Department's most recent analysis of human rights in Niger, it was released just last month. I mean, it catalogs you know, a tremendous number of abuses, including credible reports of arbitrary and unlawful killings by the government. It says very explicitly that the armed forces are accused of executing persons who are suspected of fighting with militants, with terrorist groups, and it catalogs also, you know, torture, arbitrary detention, unjustified arrests, life-threatening prison conditions, and also rampant impunity among the security forces. Now, this hasn't dissuaded the State Department from also throwing, you know, its full-fledged support behind the government in Niger, but you know, there is an appreciation of this, that these abuses are going on. The U.S. just hasn't acted on it. You know, one of the most egregious that I discovered in my reporting was it was something that was actually brought to light by Niger's own National Commission on Human Rights. They investigated allegations that in 2020, during just a one-week-long military operation, 102 civilians had disappeared from one of the areas that Niger security forces were operating in during a counterterrorism operation. And they did an on-the-ground investigation, which is very odd for Niger. There aren't a lot of fact-finding missions that go on in these areas that they call Zone Rouge or Red Zones, terrorist hotbeds. And this National Commission found 71 bodies in 6 mass graves. Human Rights Watch went in afterward. They discovered an additional 6 mass graves with 34 bodies. And this was just in the space of 1 week that these killings were carried out. So, you know, it really shows the type of operations that are going on. And again, this was just one circumscribed area, but these operations are going on a regular basis in the east of the country and also in the far west of the country. You know, I wouldn't be surprised that if more investigations were carried out, that you would find more evidence of killings of this nature, because it's certainly the type of thing that I heard about from witnesses and survivors in these areas.
One particular country I want to ask you about, which I think that there's some greater degree of U.S. public attention to, among other sub-Saharan African countries or countries in the Horn of Africa, is Somalia. So presently, the U.S. is engaged in an armed conflict in support of the Somali government against al-Shabaab. You mentioned earlier that under the Trump administration, that presence was wound down, but now it's being ramped up a bit. Can you talk a bit about what the U.S. government is doing in Somalia, or what the goal of this mission is to support the government and what the contours of it are today?
Sure. This is one of the longest standing, you know, U.S. conflicts in the world, one of the longest standing in Africa. It's been going on for, you know, the better part of 20 years now. The United States has a robust presence in Somalia, several U.S. bases where the United States operates drones, some of them armed. They conduct airstrikes in the country in support of the Somali government, and that government is in the midst of a major counterinsurgency campaign right now against primarily against al-Shabaab, the preeminent terror group there. The United States does a lot of training. It's built forces in the country that you know, some of which the United States uses as proxies. One is the DANAB, or Lightning Brigade. There's also a force called the Puntland Security Force that was built by the CIA and then transferred to military control as surrogates for the United States under a program called, or an authority, known in U.S. code as 127E or 127 Echo. And you know, this authority allows the United States to hand-select an indigenous force, arm it, train it, advise it, and send it out in the field to conduct missions for U.S. policy aims, which may or may not align with that of the host government. It's a very shadowy program. The operations are classified, but the United States has used it to an astonishing extent in Somalia.
So you described a very expansive network of bases and military operations spanning many, many different countries across a huge territorial space in Africa. Do we know anything about the budget expenditures on the AFRICOM's presence in these countries? And how can we ballpark the figures in terms of how much U.S. taxpayer money is being spent to pursue these various different conflicts in the continent?
It's a very good question, and one that's very difficult to answer. If you know, to take the example we're just talking about, Somalia, there is actually no good budgetary information on the full extent of U.S. expenditures in Somalia over the last 20 years. Only about 6 years of the last 20 has the United States had a detailed counterterrorism budget for Somalia that you could parse and figure out exactly how much is being provided. Yeah, you know, these are closely held secrets. Yeah, you know, just to take Niger as an example. You know, since 2012, you know, U.S. taxpayers have shelled out about $500 million for security assistance there. In neighboring Burkina Faso, you know, close to $1 billion over the last 20 years. And that gives you an idea of the type of money that we're talking about. But, you know, a full accounting doesn't exist, and it's, you know, it's just a black box when it comes to the Pentagon's budget.
So this brings me to another issue, which has been in the news quite a bit recently, which is the presence of another power in Africa, which is Russia. The New York Times had a story about Russian mercenaries from the Wagner Group being space stationed in sub-Saharan Africa, particularly in Central African Republic, and doing something a little bit similar to what you're describing in AFRICOM's presence and partnering with local governments to fight their defined enemies, with the difference being that they're specifically doing it for cash payment and acting effectively as mercenaries for the government in a much more straightforward way than the U.S. military is. What can we say about the involvement of foreign governments other than the U.S. in the region? And thinking of Russia and Wagner Group, but also France and other countries which have a colonial presence and seek to maintain that today.
Yeah, I mean, especially in West Africa, the French have had, you know, as you said, they're the colonial power in the region. They've had a major military presence. And I think it's in great extent the failures of the French and the U.S. counterterrorism efforts over 20 years have really opened the door to Wagner and Russian influence in the region. You know, after all this time, after all this money spent, the metrics have gone so far in the other direction that governments and peoples of these nations have become fed up. They've cast around for, you know, someone, you know, another partner, and Wagner has been there. You know, I wouldn't classify Wagner as a positive influence in the region. It had been implicated in a great deal of abuses, atrocities. This is something that you hear U.S. officials talk about quite a bit. You know, recently, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, you know, where Wagner has been present, bad things have inevitably followed. And he, you know, made the case for the United States being the solution to this, and said that the United States had to show that it could deliver results. But, you know, as we've been saying, the U.S. already has a two-decade record of counterterrorism engagement in the region, And you could say that exactly what Blinken did, that bad things and overall worsening security have been the hallmarks of those years. There's a reason why Wagner's been invited in, and I think to a great extent it's been U.S. and also French failures.
You know, you've kind of been a roving reporter in Africa for quite some time now, and you've been covering these U.S. military operations or the context around the operations to a degree which very few other U.S. reporters have done in the past two decades. Do you see a disconnect in terms of the extent of U.S. military involvement in Africa and the level of awareness or discussion of it back in the United States?
Most definitely. I mean, it's always been very difficult to get Americans to show any interest in U.S. military operations and activity in Africa. I think this has allowed the United States to operate with a great deal of impunity on the continent. There's very little oversight, accountability, because the American public just isn't engaged. And I think most Americans have a difficult time finding any of these countries on a map, let alone trying to figure out what might be going on there. They don't pay attention to the news coming out of Africa, and perhaps the only time that this has really been on the radar of most Americans was in 2017. This was also an operation in Niger. There was an ambush of U.S. troops near the village of Tongo Tongo. Four U.S. service members were killed, two others injured. And following that, you had a number of key U.S. senators even saying that they had no idea that U.S. troops were operating there. These included members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, the people in America who should most know what the United States is doing in Africa. So I think when there's that level or the lack of awareness of this among people who are supposedly overseeing it, it's not a surprise that most Americans don't know about it. But I think it's been to the detriment of America, and most certainly Africans in these nations.
Actually, one thing I also want to ask you too, it's very interesting. At the start of our conversation, you mentioned that AFRICOM encompasses all of Africa except for Egypt. Can you talk a bit about the AFRICOM operations in North Africa outside of Egypt? Obviously, there are governments there, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, which, culturally and politically, they have differences from sub-Saharan Africa. What is the nature of AFRICOM presence in those countries, and what type of conflicts are they involved in there?
Yeah, the United States has had heavy engagement in North Africa for a long time. Tunisia has actually been a real hotspot for the program that I mentioned earlier, the Authority 127 Echo. For years, the United States had commandos on the ground operating with Tunisian counterparts, what can only be described as combat, ground combat against Al-Qaeda affiliates in that region. And, this was also in 2017, the United States was engaged in a firefight on the ground in the Kasserine Mountains in Tunisia. AFRICOM still won't admit that that's where this operation took place. The only thing you can get them to say is that it was in North Africa, but it was very much in Tunisia. And it's indicative of the type of operations the United States has been able to conduct in secret because there hasn't been a great deal of oversight. The United States was heavily involved in fighting in Libya for years, starting with the civil war to oust Muammar Gaddafi back in 2011. The United States spearheaded the NATO bombing efforts in the country, and in the years after that, had a robust presence of commandos on the ground for many years. Then U.S. forces were pulled out for a few years in the late 2010s, but I understand there's now a U.S. presence on the ground and a base in Libya again. There at one time there was something like four or five. There's at least one right now, and I think a growing U.S. special operations presence in the country. During the Obama administration, the United States also conducted a tremendous number of airstrikes, hundreds of airstrikes against ISIS affiliate who was operating in Libya. This was one of the primary spots of U.S. drone war in Africa. That's wound down in recent years, but there's still a great deal of U.S. surveillance flights over the region, ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. So North Africa is still a major source of concern and engagement for AFRICOM.
Yeah. So, Nick, can you talk a bit about other great power involvement in Africa, particularly with regards to China? China obviously has been looking into Africa for a source of resources. They've been investing in infrastructure in various African countries. And the U.S. has, rhetorically at least, evinced a desire to confront China's presence in various parts of the world, including in Africa in recent years. Can you talk a bit about what China is doing there that we know, and then how we've seen the U.S. respond to it?
Sure. Yeah, I think you've seen, but when you compare and contrast U.S. engagement in Africa with China's, you can't travel anywhere in Africa without seeing Chinese presence. But the Chinese have gone very much the soft power approach, and they've pursued economic engagement, economic partnerships. Oftentimes, there seems to be to the detriment of countries. But one thing that you can't argue with is that the Chinese have a bold, robust presence. You see large projects, airports, major road infrastructure projects, that type of thing. And, the United States, its engagement on the continent very much seems to be, this counterterrorism whack-a-mole. One example that's always struck me was that the United States has an economic form of economic engagement called the Millennium Challenge Corporation, where it attempts to compete with China in infrastructure building projects. A few years ago in Mali, the United States gave the Malian government a major grant for an infrastructure project for building a stadium. But there were no U.S. corporations that were interested in actually fulfilling this contract. So it eventually went to a state-run Chinese firm. So this was American taxpayer dollars, but on the ground, people who saw the stadium being built saw that it was a Chinese company, Chinese workers. It looks like a Chinese project. And I think this is one of the ways that the United States has been beaten by China on the continent. Even when the United States has found inroads, the Chinese have been able to use it for their advantage.
And, Niger and other countries, obviously, they're quite rich deposits of certain resources like uranium and so forth as well, too. Have we seen any economic competition between foreign powers over access to these resources? And I'm very curious, actually, related to that, the interest of former colonial powers like France in the region. Like, why do they want to maintain a footprint? And why, besides terrorism, might the U.S. be interested in the region and having some presence there?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you mentioned uranium in Niger. Now, this is exceptionally important to France. The French nuclear power industry relies on uranium from Niger. So, obviously France has a vested interest, and it's one of the reasons why they've had such a continued robust presence in the Sahel, in Niger specifically. The United States, there are some U.S. firms with economic interest there, but U.S. companies have been interested. Generally, they've lost out and haven't been the beneficiaries of this. So, in many respects, the U.S. investment in Niger, if it ever pans out, it might be very good for France, but for U.S. firms, I don't think that there's a real economic advantage to it, even if it did work, which it hasn't over the last 20 years.
So the U.S. has taken a position of winding down the war on terror around much of the Middle East in the last couple of years and pivoting towards Asia or other parts of the world where they feel that they're more pressing geopolitical concerns. So we've seen less active involvement in the Middle East and talks of drawing down from residual bases and so forth. But in Africa, it seems like the story is quite different. How do you see the trajectory of the U.S. military in Africa going? And can we expect broader and more deployments and activities in the future?
Yeah, I think very much so. And as I said earlier, I think the war on terror has really gone on unabated in Africa. We've heard pledges from the White House, the Biden administration, of ending forever wars, but Africa seems to have been left out of this. And while I think there's been an uptick of U.S. commandos sent to other theaters in addition to the Middle East, Europe, and the Pacific, AFRICOM still gets a large percentage of the amount of special operations forces sent around the world. And there seems to be a renewed emphasis on North Africa, West Africa, and also the Somali theater, that the Biden administration has increased troop numbers in each of these areas. So I think you're going to see the U.S. war continue there, and very possibly at an uptick.
Nick Turse, thanks for joining us on Intercepted.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Nick Turse, a contributing writer for The Intercept, reporting on national security and foreign policy. His most recent story for The Intercept is titled AFRICOM Chief to Congress: We Share Core Values with Coup Leaders. And that's it for this episode of Intercepted. Intercepted is a production of The Intercept. Jose Oliveras is the lead producer. Supervising producer is Laura Flynn. Roger Hodge is editor-in-chief of The Intercept. Rick Kwan mixed our show. Our theme music, as always, was composed by DJ Spooky. If you'd like to support our work, go to theintercept.com/join. Your donation, no matter what the amount, makes a real difference. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Intercepted. And definitely do leave us a rating or review. It helps to find us. If you want to give us feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. That's podcasts@theintercept.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Murtaza Hussain.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.